Greetings and welcome to Our Americas, the weekly report on Latin America and the Caribbean. I'm Mario Murillo. On today's program, we'll have an update on breaking developments in Colombia with correspondent Carlos Andres Perez, who's currently in Medellin, Colombia. Then we'll have a report on the growing movement of black solidarity across the Americas. Recently, a number of representatives from various black organizations across the continent attended a conference at the UN on sustainable development. We'll hear from two leaders from Honduras and Peru. Later in the program, we'll play more highlights from a recent conference held in New York entitled Race and the Construction of the Puerto Rican Identity, which examined the many aspects of race and racism in the Puerto Rican experience, both on the island and in the diaspora. All of this and more coming up next, but first, here are some stories making headlines this week in Our Americas.
With news from Our Americas, I'm Sarah Gill.
And I'm Walter Krukmal. In Colombia, outrage over a fresh rash of killings by paramilitary forces has culminated in several days of protests and strikes. A pause for peace, held countrywide on May 20th at noon, was a minute of silence and work stoppage to protest the government's inaction after 50 paramilitary gunmen slaughtered 12 people and disappeared 42 more in Barranca Bermeja on May 17th. Witnesses of the massacre say that police and army roadblocks were set up around the city the evening before, but were withdrawn from key points shortly before the dawn paramilitary raid. The neighborhoods that were attacked are considered hardcore support bases for the National Liberation Army, or ELN, guerrillas.
Also in Colombia, peasants and human rights officials are saying that police are secretly spraying drug crops with a chemical not yet approved by the Colombian government that could devastate lush rainforests and food crops. Coca growers have said that planes backed by helicopter gunships have dumped an oily granular herbicide several times in the past month on illicit coca plantations in the dense jungle region of Caguán in Caquetá province. The herbicide, tebuthiron, is manufactured by the same U.S. company that created Agent Orange. Nearby villagers suspect that authorities, perceiving them to be rebel supporters, are taking revenge on the rural towns. The Caguán area is where guerrilla forces handed the Colombian army its worst defeat of the country's long-running civil war.
In Argentina, justice may be served in the 1997 execution-style murder of investigative photojournalist José Luis Cabezas. Judge José Luis Macchi has ordered the arrest of Alfredo Yabrán, a businessman accused of heading a mafia with ties to the government and the judiciary. Yabrán became the number one suspect after Cabezas' body was found in a ditch in January of 1997. He had been handcuffed, beaten, shot, doused with fuel, and burnt. Cabezas had been investigating corruption in the Buenos Aires Police Department. He was also the first photographer to get pictures of the 53-year-old millionaire's secretive life. Yabrán repeatedly denied having anything to do with the newsman's murder, although he has been in hiding since the accusation.
Also in Argentina, former Dirty War officer Alfredo Astiz has been indicted for allegedly justifying the thousands of deaths and disappearances by the military juntas a decade ago. The indictment was prompted by comments Astiz made in an article in Tres Puntos magazine last year. He outraged human rights groups and embarrassed the government by stating that the military taught him how to destroy and that he was, quote, the best-trained man in Argentina to kill journalists and politicians. He also made threats against reporters investigating dirty war crimes and defended the murderous campaign against suspected leftists that left an estimated 30,000 dead or disappeared over the seven-year-long dictatorship. Astiz was briefly jailed in barracks and stripped of rank, uniform, and benefits as a retired naval captain. He claims to have been misquoted. Due to amnesty laws, which President Carlos Menem helped to pass in the late 80s, Astiz cannot be prosecuted for human rights crimes.
In Mexico, a democracy rights group has collected testimony from indigenous communities in besieged Chiapas, which they charge connect the police and the military to right-wing death squads in the area. The Citizens Movement for Democracy, a grouping of diverse Mexican civic organizations, has visited Polho, Acteal, Aguatinta, Taniperlas, and Morelia to collect testimony about the recent spate of paramilitary violence and massacres in that highland area. Acteal is the site of last December's massacre of 45 unarmed peasants, while Taniperlas and Morelia have been declared autonomous municipalities in defiance of the government's rule of law there. The group's goal was to bring back stories of the abuses suffered by communities seen as supporters of the Zapatista National Liberation Army, or EZLN. beaten women, destroyed reserves of grain, and looting were some of the abuses that witnesses testified were done with the complicity of the armed forces. The Cedillo administration has repeatedly distanced itself from military and paramilitary abuses, saying it seeks a peaceful solution to the Chiapas conflict. In El Salvador, a judge will consider a request next week to free five National Guardsmen convicted of raping and killing three U.S. nuns and a lay worker in 1980. The Supreme Court said Tuesday the judge would begin considering the prisoners' petition for freedom under a new law that grants early release to some inmates in an effort to ease prison overcrowding. The guardsmen were sentenced to 30 years in prison in May 1984 and have been jailed since 1981. They will be given credit for time served before their conviction. Roman Catholic nuns Dorothy Kazel, Ida Ford, Maura Clark, and layworker Jean Donovan were stopped on a rural road December 2, 1980. They were raped and shot dead at the height of a 12-year civil war between leftist guerrillas and military-backed governments.
Fires are destroying forests at alarming rates throughout Mexico, where in the first 4 months of this year, more than 9,000 fires claimed 47 lives and 250,000 hectares of forest. In Central America, 13,200 fires have claimed close to 240,000 hectares, and several airports have been closed due to smoke. Near Guatemala's ancient Maya city of Tikal, flames are closing in. Honduras reports flames reaching tourist destinations such as La Tigra, La Candón, and Sots, and over 4,000 people hospitalized with respiratory problems. Temperatures in the region have reached up to 40 degrees centigrade, and rains are not expected for at least another week.
And in Santo Domingo, recently deceased ex-presidential candidate José Francisco Peña Gómez and the Dominican Revolutionary Party were big winners in legislative elections the weekend of May 16th. Voters also elected merengue singer and orchestra leader Johnny Ventura to the mayoralty of the capital city. Longtime president Balaguer's party, however, the Social Christian Reform Party, lost 45 seats in the lower house and barely held on with two seats in the Senate and seven town halls.
And those are some of the stories coming out of Latin America this week. For Our Americas, I'm Sarah Gill.
And I'm Walter Krockmal.
And you're listening to Our Americas, the weekly report on Latin America and the Caribbean. I'm Mario Murillo. In other news this week, as you heard earlier coming out of Colombia, the Attorney General's office says it'll investigate reports that the army and police may have played a role in the murder of 11 people and the kidnapping of 40 others in Barranca Bermeja over the weekend of May 16th. Human rights groups and the Colombia Commission of Jurists say police and army troops roam the poorer neighborhoods of Barranca Bermeja, 335 miles northeast of Bogotá, warning residents that they were there to re-establish order. Correspondent Carlos Andrés Pérez is in Medellín and prepared this summary of the week's events in a tumultuous Colombia.
On May 19th, millions of Colombians waved white handkerchiefs in the air, clamoring for peace and an end to the violence that has engulfed the nation and most recently claimed the lives of 11 people in the northern city of Barranca Bermeja. The recently formed Frente Social Amplio, a loose coalition of religious organizations, human rights advocates, and various NGOs, called for the nationwide gesture in order to protest the recent spate of massacres and massive displacement of farmers triggered by increasingly bold paramilitary attacks on unarmed civilians. On Saturday, May 17th, more than 50 masked gunmen brandishing a list of presumed guerrilla collaborators dragged over 50 people from their homes in the oil-refining town of Barranca Bermeja, summarily executing 11 of them. They also kidnapped 40 more. Serious questions have been raised about the army and police's failure to prevent the massacre, which witnesses report lasted more than 3 hours, time in which army and police patrols ignored desperate calls for help. One man who escaped reported that the other 40 men had been tied to trees, judged by makeshift tribunals, and some were then shot. The Petroleum Workers Union, the USO, and other civic organizations have called for an open-ended civil strike in Barranca Bermeja, which houses nearly all of Colombia's oil infrastructure. Analysts estimate that severe fuel shortages could ensue if the strike goes on for more than a week. USO President Hernando Hernández and other strike coordinators are calling for President Samper to convene a state council in Barranca Bermeja as a means of pressuring paramilitaries to release all of the 43 persons kidnapped on the 17th. Human rights groups in the area have expressed outrage that military intelligence officers were videotaping participants in the peaceful protest, and they're also concerned that the same vehicles used in attack have been seen around town and have evoked little response from the authorities. Also on May 19th, President Ernesto Samper and the military high command announced the dismantling of the infamous 20th Brigade, an independent military intelligence unit long singled out by local and international human rights advocates for sponsoring massacres, disappearances, and extrajudicial executions. It was information coming from the 20th Brigade that led to the disastrous raid on May 19th of the offices of the Intercongregational Commission for Justice and Peace, a human rights NGO based in Bogota. Television images of nuns and priests kneeling while assault troops wearing night vision equipment carted away files containing sensitive reports of human rights violations lent credibility in the mind of most Colombians to increasingly stronger international criticism of the intelligence brigade's activities. In a statement, Armed Forces Chief General Jose Bonnet admitted that an internal investigation had uncovered serious irregularities within the 20th Brigade, but denied that its dismantlement was in any way related to recent accusations coming from Washington that the unit was partly responsible for Colombia's deplorable human rights record. It should be noted, however, that the 20th Brigade was started in 1990 with the assistance of the U.S. Southern Command in Panama, and many of its commanding officers were trained at the School of the Americas in Fort Benning, Georgia. For Our Americas, this is Carlos Andres Perez in Medellin, Colombia.
De mi gente negra son un desfile de melas en flor que cuando pasan frente a mí se alegra de su negrura todo el corazón. Las caras lindas de mi raza prieta.
In April, by invitation of the Pan-Africanist movement, representatives from black organizations of Honduras, Peru, and Uruguay came to the 6th UN Conference on Sustainable Development in New York. For the first time ever, they were able to voice concerns about their social and political struggles in this international venue. Although they're not yet voting members of that body, their visit to New York and subsequent meetings in Washington, D.C. with prominent African-American leaders is a major first step in uniting people of African descent in the northern and southern hemispheres. Producer Walter Krockmal prepared this report.
One of the people attending the conference at the UN was Honduran labor leader Celio Álvarez Casildo, president of the Central American Black Organization, or CABO. Casildo was named a member of the UN Southern Caucus, where he will represent the Central and South American constituencies of African descent. Mr. Casildo talked to us about the principal problems facing his community. Among those are the struggle for land, which is pitting the Honduran Black and Garifuna communities against national and international interests that seek to introduce large-scale tourist development projects along Honduras' virgin Atlantic coast.
La problemática de la tierra sigue siendo la columna vertebral de el abordaje del movimiento afro hondureño.
The land problem is still the backbone of the Afro-Honduran movement's approach at the Central American level as well. To date, we've managed to get the Honduran government to issue the first 16 titles for 10 communities and 6 agricultural cooperatives. The new government has pledged to follow up on the agreement signed on October 11, 1996, and as a result of the March of the Drums, which was the first time any Honduran government committed itself to the Garifuna community, the black community, to resolve the landholding problem. We have serious problems in Honduras, which also apply to the rest of the Central American countries. A major problem is proportional and representative participation in the various branches of government. There were elections in Honduras recently, and out of 20 ministers appointed, not one, either man or woman, represents the black community. The same happened in the Supreme Court of Justice and in the diplomatic corps at the national and international levels. This is a sign of moving backward because while during the last government, the Garifuna, Dr. Gerardo Martinez Blanco was the ambassador to the United Nations and he represented the Afro-Honduran community, today there isn't anyone, So we've taken a step backward. There's a greater institutionalization of what we call racism or discrimination. It's a sign that we have to step up our organizational work, not in order to recover spaces, but to create those spaces which correspond to us by aspiration and by right.
Que hay un retroceso, porque sin el gobierno anterior, el embajador de Honduras ante las Naciones Unidas era un miembro de la comunidad afro-hondureña, un garífuna, el doctor...
In contrast to the Afro-Honduran movement, spearheaded by the Garifuna people who possess a powerful sense of their identity, the community in Peru presents an entirely different profile. Dr. Jorge Ramirez Reina is president of the Organization for the Defense of Black Human Rights of Peru and also attended the UN Conference on Sustainable Development. He says they haven't gotten to a level of a national black identity.
En cuanto a la población negra o afro-peruana, existe una diferencia muy marcada.
Regarding the black or Afro-Peruvian movement, there is a marked difference between it and other communities in Central and South America. There are no statistics by race. In Peru, we're all mestizos, so it's difficult to identify percentages by race. We have, through our organizational work, calculated that we are between 6 and 8% of the country's population. That amounts to almost 2 million and a fraction of Afro-Peruvians. What stands out the most is that in Peru, the term Afro isn't used, because blacks in Peru didn't come from Africa. The phenomenon there was that we were brought over from slave repositories in Colombia and Panama. The slaves who came to Peru were 11 to 12-year-old Catholics who spoke Spanish. That's why they were very expensive slaves. It also contributed to the fact that there isn't a marked Afro-Peruvian culture as there is in Brazil and Central America. There's no language such as the Garifuna language. The practice of Santeria doesn't exist. There are no African beliefs in Orishas. You won't see blacks wearing tunics or turbans or headdresses. All of us dress like white folks. The result is a strong identity crisis. Lack of identity on the one hand and invisibility on the other. I was saying before that the word black is used only twice in our history, when we were slaves and when we were free. So according to the government, blacks didn't do anything. That proves the thing about our invisibility which we're trying to turn around. They look at themselves in the mirror and see a black person, but not an African person. They feel like black Peruvians, not like Afro-Peruvians. That's one part of the problem.
Asked about the issues facing the black Peruvian community within the context of Peruvian society at large, Dr. Reina points out the similarities between his community and other Afro-communities in Latin America. In doing so, he lays the bedrock for organizational strategies in that country.
On the other hand, we have to undertake a campaign of social sensitization to the racial problem. There's a very strong problem with racism in Peru, covert racism. Just like in Honduras and other Latin American countries, there are no high-ranking blacks in the military, as ministers, congresspeople, or mayors, no blacks as governors or prefects, and no blacks in the clergy. In other words, there are no black bishops. So there is political and social exclusion of blacks. We are relegated to unskilled labor. There are very few black professionals. Being a black professional is a via crucis, because racism starts in school and follows you all the way to the university, so it's an impossible situation. I'll tell you a story from my university days. I was in my first year of law school, and one of my professors asked me, "You're going to be a lawyer?" I said, "Yes." "So you're going to denigrate our profession because of your color." That's a deep-rooted concept.
Recién ingresadito a la universidad, y un profesor se acercó y me dijo, "¿Tú vas a ser abogado?" Sí, le dije. Entonces basta de denigrar nuestra profesión por tu color.
To explain the differences that set apart Peru's blacks and their struggle with other Latin American peoples of African descent, Dr. Reina says the circumstances under which blacks arrived in Peru were unique. He also points to modern developments regarding the issue of landholding.
Primeramente te digo de que la esclavitud en el Perú fue una esclavitud casi totalmente urbana.
Slavery in Peru was almost entirely urban. The fact that blacks were Catholics and spoke Spanish contributed to their being used in domestic service. This doesn't rule out the possibility of there being blacks in rural areas. There are black communities in rural areas of Peru. What makes it different from other countries like Honduras and Colombia or Ecuador, which have a land problem, is that our land problem was solved as a result of a coup d'etat and the agrarian reform, brought about by General Velasco Alvarado, around 64 or 65 more or less. The agrarian reform gave possessors or landholders a title, quote-unquote, so most blacks in rural communities are landholders, and even if they don't have titles, they've been on the land for a certain amount of years. The problem really comes when it's harvest time, but there isn't an expropriation problem like there is in the Choco region, or like in Honduras, where they need titles to really feel like landowners. Possession in Peru practically amounts to ownership of land.
Poseen la tierra durante muchos años, y el problema es más en la cosecha de sus productos.
Honduran labor leader Celio Álvarez Casildo described attempts at building internal coalitions in the Afro-Honduran community with the indigenous communities, all of which are threatened by attacks on their traditional lands. Casildo says that while it appears that this is an example of communities unable to reach consensus on common strategies, it's also something that all struggles for racial and social justice must go through before they are able to formulate effective strategies in their own societies.
Nosotros creemos que las alianzas, las coordinaciones, en su más amplio sentido,
we believe that alliances and coordination are the most important elements for there to be solid responses to the community's main problems. In this case, the indigenous and Afro communities have land problems. If we can manage to converge around this process with an eye toward unity in action, we think it will be easier, will be stronger and better represented. However, there are interests that oppose that. Not all those who are in the indigenous or the Afro movement are friends, or are there with their heart and thoughts and actions at the service of that cause. Many are from the fifth column, people who in fact are attempting to sabotage any unifying process. That's why we can't understand how a colleague, using the term indigenous in its broadest sense, can create opposition, or start up intrigues, or attempt to create false expectations regarding the serious struggle that's being carried out. We see that everywhere. Last year, we made several attempts to contact the most serious indigenous movement in the country so we could undertake a process of coordination. This has been going on since 1996. Up to this moment, it's been impossible. In modern terms, the Afro-Honduran movement is an incipient one. It starts at the end of the 70s, and today there are more than 20 black organizations in the country with various interests. Most of them, the so-called NGOs or private organizations, sell technical services. They get a lot of money, but they don't get involved with the community to wake it up. They don't raise the banner of the struggle in the streets. Just like you work behind the desk, you don't go out into the streets, go out and wake up people's consciousness. That's what we call solidarity, the ongoing struggle to reconstruct or construct a space of dignity for the people. They don't do that. So we enter a period of contradiction, which is normal, and I say normal because contradiction is a natural law of development. So we can assume that aside from all these obstacles, we're making progress because we're in constant contact with our community, and we're doing all the necessary lobbying so that people understand that it's important to sit down at the table and coordinate all those things that are in our common interests. You have to push the cart in the same direction.
O por construir un espacio de dignidad para su pueblo. Eso no se hace.
While Casildo points out the intricacies and challenges presented by the effort to establish a united front in the struggle for ethnic lands in Honduras, he also makes reference to the larger efforts that are necessary for any such movement to be successful in the age of globalization. In the case of Honduras, these efforts are being targeted at other sectors of Honduran society and at an African-American constituency that numbers close to 150 million people in Central and South America. The results are beginning to show fruit and will have important repercussions throughout the continent between now and the close of the century. Of particular importance are upcoming events in Panama and in the port city of La Ceiba, Honduras, the same city that hosted the bicentennial of the arrival of the Garinagu in Honduras in April of 1997.
En octubre sacamos un documento donde invitamos a los diferentes sectores.
Last year in October, we published a document through which we invited the various sectors, the labor movement, the indigenous movement, the Afro movement, the women's movement, the peasant movement, to initiate talks at the national level. This year, as we review everything that's happening, we're proposing reconciliation and unity talks for the Afro-Honduran movement. This is an initiative put forward by the grassroots organization that I represent, ODECO, the Organization for Ethnic Community Development. At the Central American level, I was unanimously re-elected to the presidency of CABO, the Central American Black Organization, last December in Guatemala, which means a commitment of another 2 years. In December of this year, we'll be holding our assembly in Bocas del Toro, Panama. Based on all these national, regional, and continent-wide convergences, and after talks in Buenaventura and
Cartagena de Indias in Colombia, as well as these meetings we're sharing with our brothers and sisters from South America here in New York. We've decided to carry out three simultaneous events in Panama. The objective is to motivate each other, draw closer to each other, and to promote the movement's unity in a most definitive way. So we'll be holding the Congress of the Afro-Latin American Caribbean Women's Movement, then we'll hold the Central American Black Organizations Assembly, and finally the Assembly of the Continental Network of Afro-American Organizations. This is going to be a beautiful space for dialogue, for convergence, a place to define strategies for the coming years.
Dr. Jorge Ramirez Reina of Peru says the implications of the assemblies in Panama this coming December and the summit in Honduras in the year 2000 are very significant. His words echo what will surely be the response of all Afro-American communities in the Americas, which, despite their silence, are slowly but surely awakening, adding their considerable strength to a struggle whose positive outcome, long overdue, is closer to being a reality than ever before.
Yo creo que esto es algo histórico. El hecho de poder congregar a diferentes organizaciones negras del continente.
I think the fact of being able to call together different black organizations, people, Afro-American brethren at this summit will allow for the continental integration of our people, a continental presence, and it will allow us a voice that says we're present and we want our development. Enough racism and discrimination. It's time to move forward. This will be a milestone in the history of the struggle for the rights of black people here in the Americas.
Dr. Jorge Ramirez Reina is president of the Organization for the Defense of Black Human Rights of Peru. For Our Americas, I'm Walter Krockmal.
Samba malato, lando, samba malato, lando, samba malato, lando. La samba se pasea por la bate, lando, samba malato, lando, samba malato, lando, samba malato.
And you're listening to Our Americas. Our Americas is produced at the studios of WBAI Pacifica Radio in cooperation with NACLA, the North American Congress on Latin America. NACLA publishes a bi-monthly journal, Report on the Americas. For more information, call 212-870-3146. That's 212-870-3146. And if you have any questions for us, you can send us an email at mmcompa@igc.org. That's mmcompa@igc.org. I'm Mario Murillo. Stay with us.